This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
At the end of last year, the Metropolitan Police seized the largest stash of illegal synthetic opioids ever found in the UK, comprising of over 150,000 tablets containing a substance called nitazine, which is many times more potent than heroin. The National Crime Agency says 54 deaths have been linked to nitazines in the last 6 months of 2023. The chemicals necessary to make them are coming in the post from China. The US has been in the grip of an opioid crisis since the 2010s. Last year, around 110,000 people died from drug overdoses. Around 70% involved another synthetic opioid, fentanyl. The number of deaths from synthetic opioids such as nitazines and fentanyl in the UK is currently small. But should we be worried that we're just in the foothills? In other words, could an opioid crisis happen here? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First of all, let's do the basics. What are synthetic opioids and what effect do they have on the body? Here with me is Rick Treble, a forensic chemist and an advisor to the government's Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. Rick Treble, starting with the very basics, what are synthetic opioids and how do they actually work?
It's been known for millennia that there are certain materials in the natural world which can get into the body and affect the way the brain works. Opium from the opium poppy has been known to produce effects in the brain, somnolence. It counteracts the effect of pain. As the Victorians began to understand and apply chemistry, we were able to separate out what was the active ingredient within the opium, and it turned out it was essentially morphine. And there are now a whole range of materials which have been developed which affect the same receptors in the brain that morphine acts on.
Morphine is the active substance out of opium,
yes,
which affects receptors in the brain, and we have discovered ways of creating that artificially. Can you tell us what purpose the synthetic opioids were originally created for? And I guess, actually, it's relatively straightforward. It was to cure pain.
Yes, that was the primary objective, and to try and overcome some of the disadvantages of morphine. Morphine is quite long-acting. It can make you feel quite unwell. So if you can come up with more advanced materials, for example, the materials which are now used in operating theatres routinely, like fentanyl, it's much easier to manage those. You can actually reverse the effects quite quickly. You can engineer the materials so they're very short-acting, so you're not walking around in a groggy haze for hours afterwards, but you can be returned to normality relatively quickly.
How easy are they to make?
They're relatively easy. They can be assembled in a relatively simple laboratory.
So what are the ingredients you need to make synthetic opioids and where do you get them from?
Well, I won't list them. I don't think this is time for a recipe book, but a lot of them can be bought. Primarily, they've been coming from China, which has a very advanced and diverse chemical industry. It's relatively easy to order materials and have them delivered around the world very quickly. There is an international system to try and control these materials, and the United Nations administers a process to control the trade in some of these more potentially dangerous materials.
Now, the opioids that a lot of people working in public health are most worried about are fentanyls and nitazines. Firstly, what's the difference between those two things? And secondly, how potent are they? How powerful?
Right, well, they're from different chemical families, but within each of those families, you can engineer the structure. You can make small adjustments to it. So you can dial up or dial down the potency of the materials to suit your end effect. So ultimately, you can come up with materials which are entirely suitable for sedating an elephant should the need arise. If we look back 20 years or so, you may remember there was a siege of a theatre in Moscow when a group of Chechens took over a theatre full of people. And the Russian authorities faced the problem of how to get them out and without doing too much damage to the many members of the audience who were in there. The answer they came up with was pumping one of the more potent fentanyls through the ventilation system. And this rendered in excess of 800 people unconscious in a matter of minutes and enabled them to break the siege. It wasn't entirely a happy ending, but it did show just the potency that it's capable of achieving with these materials.
Why wasn't it a happy ending?
When you've been exposed to opiates or opioids, one of the side effects of the receptor that they act on is that it depresses the respiratory function. So you slow down your breathing and eventually you can stop breathing. That can be reversed very quickly if you've got the right antidote at hand. But in this case, they had so many people to deal with and the antidote wasn't applied to enough people quickly enough.
So in other words, a lot of people asphyxiated.
Yes, yeah.
And that is the principal danger, is it, from what we call an overdose of these synthetic opioids, is that what you die from is you stop breathing.
Yes, it can have other unfortunate effects. It can affect the heart as well, but primarily your breathing slows down and stops.
Obviously, when you take it as an anaesthetic, you are going to take it intravenously and an expert is going to administer it to you in exactly what they think is the right dose for what they want. When you're not taking it as an anaesthetic, as a drug to affect your mood and so on, how is it then generally ingested?
For most people, they will be taking it the way they would normally take a drug. So for people who are injecting drug users, they will probably be injecting it because it's what they're used to doing. But also, there are a large number of people who take tablets to get the effect of an opiate. For example, just before Christmas, there was a case in London where something in excess of 150,000 fake tablets were seized. And they were made to look like a commercial pharmaceutical. But in fact, they've been laced with nitazenes. So the idea is, because these things can be 100, 1,000 times more potent than traditional morphine-like materials, for somebody who's in the drugs trade, there's a big incentive to use these materials because it's a lot easier to smuggle them, to move them about without being discovered.
And because they simply look like other things, thus creating all kinds of dangers, not least for children in places where people are using these materials.
Potentially, yes. The big risk, I think, is for people who are already drug users and are not aware that their supply might be contaminated with fentanyls or nitazenes.
Given the dangers, however, why wouldn't I rather, if I was a heroin addict, stick to heroin, which is less likely to kill me, than have fentanyl either mixed with it or take fentanyl instead?
Right. Well, now I'm a chemist rather than a psychologist, so you probably need to ask somebody else that question. But I think once you're powerfully drawn to these materials, it's very, very difficult to kick the habit.
You said there's an antidote.
There is. There's something called naloxone. And it works by going to the receptor sites in the brain and essentially jostling aside the opiate or opioid that's there and clearing it from the receptor. And the effect when it's applied is quite miraculous. People who are unconscious within a matter of minutes are back on their feet.
Rate Treble. We now have a good idea of what opioids are. So let's examine in more detail what happened in the US to see if we can draw some lessons. Sam Quinones is a journalist and author of Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam Quinones, we've obviously heard about the large number of deaths from the opioid crisis in the US. Can you talk us down the route by which they became such a huge problem?
Well, I think it begins in the mid-1990s when we saw a revolution in American medicine when, as regards opioid painkillers, that is, drugs that derive from the opium poppy that were used up to that point, really only for terminal cancer patients and immediately post-surgical patients. But in the mid-1990s, pain specialists combined with pharmaceutical companies to make the argument that these pills could be used far, far more widely because science now knew that if you were in pain, if you were a pain patient given these pills, you would not become addicted. In fact, science knew nothing of the kind, but this idea was propounded at lots of conferences. Eventually, major medical institutions got on board with it. Prescription opioid painkillers from doctors began to be used all across the country. The numbers of prescriptions just skyrocketed. And of course, we found out that in fact, that segment of the population that used these would in fact become addicted, did in fact become addicted. Sometimes doctors would cut them off. Sometimes they would have to go to the street to buy the pills on the street. Gradually, the Mexican trafficking, drug trafficking world began to figure out that there was this new market in the United States for heroin, and they began to supply more and more heroin to the U.S. market than they really had been doing in previous. And people began to transition to heroin. You saw this widespread addiction to the pills and to heroin really across the country. Along the way, the Mexican trafficking world figured out that there was something called what they called synthetic heroin, heroína sintética, which turned out to be, in fact, a drug very well known in medicine called fentanyl. Fentanyl is a synthetic, meaning it's made only with chemicals, no plants involved. They began to realize that fentanyl was a substitute for heroin, could be provided extraordinarily cheaply. The deaths have skyrocketed now.
What impact does it have on the communities where this is most prevalent?
These drugs are creating, I think, major drivers of homelessness and our mental illness problem that we are seeing in localities all across the country. People just completely incapable of governing their lives. Outreach workers will come and say, hey, we got a bed for you. We got some treatment beds available. You can get you off the street. The temperatures are about to turn lethal and so on. And people will refuse that treatment because they are terrified of the withdrawals, of being away from the drug. I had a counselor at a conference tell me recently, my clients, she said, are afraid of two things. One is dying from fentanyl because everybody on the street knows they're going to die if they stay on the street. And at the same time, the other thing they're afraid of is being away from fentanyl.
So what are the principal strategies that the US authorities have used to try and deal with this problem? And to what extent have they had any success?
Well, I think a lot of the strategies in the United States are left to local communities. They're left to law enforcement at the local, county, and state level.
I'm slightly surprised to hear what you say about it being essentially a local problem, because what you've described to us is a huge national public health crisis. Is that not how it's actually seen by the federal authorities in the US?
That's a terrific question. I think there is growing recognition that this is a national problem. One of the problems we have is that we have a government in Mexico that I don't believe is at all interested in addressing this in the least, has done nothing to police the amount, the chemicals that are coming in from China, the precursor ingredients that are used to make fentanyl. They have done nothing about that.
Right, Sam, what about the choking off of demand? In other words, it started, as you described it, as a mass overprescription of opioids by doctors. I'm presuming that mass overprescription has stopped. So doesn't that mean that in the US, the numbers of people affected will fall?
You are right about that. The mass prescribing, the way we used to see it for 20 years, has certainly changed. So now you're seeing many people who once were occasional cocaine users now become regular fentanyl users. Fentanyl is a wonderful drug surgically. One reason for that is it takes you in and out of anesthesia very quickly, unlike morphine, in which they're dopey for like 5-6 hours after that. With fentanyl, it's very, very quick. And that is a wonderful attribute of the drug that allows its use in surgeries for last 60 years. However, when it's on the street, it's a complete torment, because what it means now is that drug users have to use all day long. Even if they're using heroin twice, three times a day, with fentanyl, it's 6-8 times a day. But what that means is, from a dealer perspective, of course, is that fentanyl's a bonanza. Somebody who once bought your cocaine every weekend is now using your fentanyl 5-6 times a day.
Now, Sam, this program is about the possible risk of synthetic opioids becoming a big thing here in Britain. And clearly, we don't have the prescription problem, which started all this for you. But what other aspects of the US experience, I think you may have hinted at some of them, should we be looking out to, because they could transfer to Britain?
That's another good question. I would say that I'm not sure that the British experience and the U.S. experience are at all the same. We do a very poor job of regulating business in general when it comes to people trying to make money. We don't stand in their way. I would say fentanyl in its staggering supplies is the experience that we're seeing here in the United States. That would be a difficult thing to replicate in the UK. You do not have the very sophisticated drug trafficking culture on your flank the way we have in Mexico. Intrusion of fentanyl into the UK could lead to a mass die-off of the people who are already addicted to heroin. I'm not so sure that it would, if it were just limited amounts of fentanyl or limited in time, stopped at some point, that it would create the demand that fentanyl is now creating in the United States.
Sam Quiñones. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about whether Britain has run out of money, the one on whether Ofsted is up to the job, and the one on whether the UK will hit its net zero targets. Now, back to opioids and the question of whether we're likely to face a growing problem here in Britain, and if so, what we should do about it. With me are Caroline Copeland, Senior Lecturer in Pharmacology and Toxicology at King's College London and the Director of the National Programme on Substance Abuse Deaths, and Alex Stevens, Professor in Criminal Justice at the University of Kent. Alex Stevens, how worried should we be about synthetic opioids becoming a big problem in the UK, do you think?
I'm quite worried, and a lot of people in the field are worried. We're starting to see the entrance of synthetic opioids into the field in a bigger way than we've seen before. There have been odd occasions of people dying of fentanyls and carfentanil over the last 10 years.
Carfentanil?
Carfentanil, which is an even more powerful version of fentanyl. But over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen these little outbreaks of nitazenes, which are even more powerful than fentanyl. And that, I think, is a harbinger of things to come as the heroin supply from Afghanistan dries up due to the Taliban's ban on it.
Alex, is it possible that there are more deaths from synthetic opioids than the confirmed ones we actually know about? In other words, some that we may not be picking up?
Unfortunately, it is, yes. So not every post-mortem that is done on people who've died with drugs includes a test for the full range of drugs they might have died from. This is why the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, which is the statutory body that advises ministers, has repeatedly advised that there be more standardisation in the toxicological tests that are done when people have died.
Cara, do you think we're underestimating the problem?
Yes, I think so as well. In addition to not all deaths being tested for, these drugs are so potent, you only need a tiny amount to cause death. And so sometimes the level that is going to be in that person's blood is going to be at undetectable levels. Think of it like you're at a supermarket self-checkout and you put a greeting card on the scale. The greeting card is there, but it's too light for the scale to recognise. It's not that it's not there, it's just it's not sufficiently heavy.
But it's the greeting card that kills you.
Exactly. So you can have a small amount that can't be detected by toxicology tests, even when they've been done in some cases, we think.
Right. So in other words, if we really wanted to know the actual scale, we would need more sensitive testing. What, earlier?
Sensitive testing, more frequent testing, up-to-date testing as well. The nitazenes are a class of synthetic opioid. That means that there's several of them that exist. And when you're screening for these drugs, you need to know which ones you're trying to look for as well.
So in other words, it would have been quite easy in the past to miss the presence of something like nitazenes.
Absolutely. The nitazene tests were not done regularly in the majority of post-mortem laboratories up until at least last year. Maybe some of them were testing a couple of years ago. But
and they think it's people tend to think it's a heroin death instead, so they put it down to that.
Depends how much heroin is also there. It's a case as well of what other drugs have been detected in a standard screen. If there's sufficient drug to cause death, you wouldn't necessarily try and look for something else. To add to that, we are aware of a number of deaths that happened in the last half of 2023 at the moment, but we know that there are many more to come. And the reason they aren't officially known about yet is because of delays in both the time it takes for a toxicology test to be completed and also for the coroners to complete their investigations. Some coronial jurisdictions have a turnaround time from between death and conclusion of inquest of about 3 months, but in some places it's up to 2 years. So we might not know the true extent of what is happening in 2023 until 2025 and beyond. We see about 50-ish fentanyl deaths a year on average, and we're already at, you know, nearly double that on the official figures, and unofficially it's going to be much more than that.
Alex, can we talk a bit about who we think would be most at risk from synthetic opioids? What groups of people, what kinds of people?
In this country, it's more confined to a group of people who largely started using heroin in the 80s and 90s in the era of mass unemployment. And those people have generally stayed using heroin for a long time. And a lot of the deaths are happening amongst people who are in their 40s and 50s who've been using heroin for 10, 20 years. And those are the people who experience the highest levels of death. They tend to be working class men who've been unemployed for a long time, living in deindustrialised areas in the northwest, northeast of England, South Wales, Glasgow, other deindustrialised cities in Scotland. And it's that population that is experiencing the current UK crisis of drug-related death, and it's they that are most vulnerable to the supply being contaminated with even more powerful opioids.
That's very interesting. You were talking about how these people have been users of heroin for a long time. Now, one of the other things that we've heard about is that the clampdown by the Taliban on the opium poppy production there has actually beginning to lead to a shortage of the conventional opium that goes into heroin, and that that might lead to a substitution with fentanyl.
Exactly. It's very complex because there is already evidence, for example, that supply is moving, as it always does. When there's successful reduction in one area, it pops up in another. It's known as the balloon effect. And there's evidence that production of opium is moving, for example, to Myanmar. In the past, when we've had shortages of heroin, for example, between 2010 and 2012, there was a shortage of heroin in Western Europe. And what we saw then is a reduction in deaths due to heroin, but an increase in deaths from other opioids, including methadone, which is a medicine that's used to sustain people's dependence and as a substitute for heroin. At that era, the increase in methadone wasn't big enough to compensate for the reduction in heroin. So what we saw was an overall reduction. That was a time when there weren't nitazine, fentanyls and other synthetic opioids in the market. The worry we have is that there's this readily available, cheap to produce, cheap to transfer because it's so small, substitute for heroin. So when criminals who can't make any money anymore from Afghan heroin think, well, who are we going to sell to this stable customer base we've got? They'll look to fentanyls and nitazines, and the death rate will climb.
A lot of the people that Alex has just described that use heroin, they aren't recreational drug users. They aren't just using to get high and have a good time. And until we can support these people with concurrent mental health support, drug and alcohol treatments, and get to the root cause of why they are using the drugs, I think that's the only real way that we're going to be stopping this from happening, because there will always be a supply of drugs for them to take otherwise.
Can I also ask you, because it seems slightly perverse to give people a drug to your customer that may very well kill them. So I'm wondering what the advantages are to drug smugglers to bringing fentanyl in compared with the usual heroin supply.
Well, it's obviously not good business, if that's what you could call it, to be killing your customers. But, you know, we know that heroin supply has been affected by the Taliban in Afghanistan. I've also seen data to show that the purity of heroin over the past few years has been decreasing as well. So it's been increasingly adulterated, mixed with other things to make it weaker. And your customers are going to want something. And if all you have is these new compounds, and you yourself, a lot of these drug gangs, I don't think that they, you know, have necessarily PhDs in analytical chemistry and know exactly what it is that they're providing. It's an experiment in itself for them as to how much to actually give in. So I don't think they're doing it necessarily deliberately, but it's, you know, what's available, but they don't know how strong these things are.
Do we need to accept, just accept, it's unlikely we're going to be able to stop synthetic opioids coming into this country, Caroline?
I think it's going to be very difficult to stop them coming in. They're easy to make, they're cheap to make, they're easy to ship. So the intervention that we need to stop is them being used in the first place. And as soon as that customer demand is gone, then I think that's the only way we're going to be able to reduce their harms.
Let's be absolutely clear. You're both saying, because you're nodding along, Alex, that actually this is not something you can deal with by tackling the supply. It's something that you have to deal with by tackling the demand.
Yes, there are countries that have realised that you're not going to arrest your way or seize your way out of this problem. And the one that my mind turns to is the Netherlands, where they've got historically and comparatively low levels of drug-related death, having had quite a big heroin problem in the 80s and 90s. And the way they've done that is not by, you know, arresting huge amounts of people and throwing away the key. They've shrunk the size of the population that is vulnerable to this by dealing with the social problems that produces that population. Housing has been a major part of that strategy.
Are there any, I don't know, experiments going on in this country, people who have been licensed in some way to look at doing things in a different way? Alex?
So The Loop, which is a charity that for several years has been running drug checking services at festivals, has also recently opened a site in Bristol where people can come and have their drugs checked in a proper and chemical way so that they are more safe because they know what's in their substances. The Loop's research has found that when people get accurate information about what's in their drugs and they find that the drug they thought they bought is not what they've got, then quite often they will hand it in for destruction rather than use it and risk their health.
Right, let's try this experiment. I'm the new Secretary of State for Health. I've just come in and I'm genuinely eager to try and stop this becoming a big problem and to take the measures which are necessary. But you've only got the length of time we're in a lift together up to the fifth floor to tell me what to do about it. Alex, what should I do about it?
In 2016, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs published a report on reducing opioid-related deaths in the UK. That suggested reducing poverty and the drivers of heroin use. It suggested improving the toxicological testing of people who die with opioids, so we know what they're dying of. It also suggested increasing the number of people who are in opioid agonist therapy, so methadone, buprenorphine. It suggested central funding of heroin-assisted treatment, which has been proven to be very successful in this country and elsewhere in helping people who don't get on with methadone or buprenorphine to get off street heroin.
And those two things are heroin substitutes, yeah?
That's right, yes. And it also suggested that the government consider opening overdose prevention centres. Now, some of those things were accepted as recommendations but never actually happened in practice. So the government, this new minister, doesn't need to go very far to look for the prescription of how to deal with this problem.
So your advice is do the things that you've already been decided to do but haven't been done?
The things that have been recommended but haven't been done, yes.
You know, if I had, you know, two flights of an elevator to pitch, I would say make sure these people get mental health support. Mental health support and drug treatment is currently funded and commissioned entirely separately in this country. And very often, people who have a drug dependency are told to sort that out first before they can access mental health services, which, just no pun intended, seems crazy because that support should be integrated.
Caroline Copeland there with Alex Stevens. My thanks to them and to Rick Treble and Sam Quinones. And my conclusion after listening to all that is, well, maybe let's stop putting all our emphasis on cutting off the supply of drugs and do a whole lot more to tackle the demand for them. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Nick Holland, Kirsty Knight and Charlotte MacDonald. The sound engineer was Rod Farker and the editor was Penny Murphy. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hi, I'm Mariana Spring, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent, and I've learned firsthand that the online world can be a breeding ground for hate. But why do some people behave the way they do on social media? For BBC Radio 4, I'm meeting the people at the heart of some extraordinary online conflicts to see if understanding, even forgiveness, is ever possible. Listen to Why Do You Hate Me on BBC Sounds.
Als Rapper gefeiert. Als Mensch im freien Fall.
Dieses Album ist ja super therapeutisch. Die ganzen Fragen, die ganzen Schmerzen.
Dein Probemonat, was Leben angeht, ist vorbei.
In Vertigo. Die Doku über OG Kimo und Funkvater Frank. Jetzt im ZDF streamen.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.